are often the first way we express our gender identity and the most common way for society to recognize it. There is often a curiosity about the names given to us at birth. This is a deeply personal piece of information for many of us. It may seem odd that many transgender people deem such information so sensitive. People who change their last name, for instance, don't usually bristle at the question, "What was your name before?" Not every trans person is uncomfortable with saying or hearing their birth name. For many of us, though, we are reluctant to give out that information because it often becomes weaponized against us, invoked instead of our chosen name to ignore and deny our gender identity. And even for the most well-intentioned cisgender people, when they see my old pictures or find out my birth name, I can see the wheels turning in their heads as they reconstruct an image of me, seeing me not in the present, but in the past. Every trans person's path to their own name is different. Some have just always known. Others pick a name that may share a first letter with their birth name. I know plenty of transgender people whose parents helped them pick their name. And not just people who transitioned young, but also individuals who came out in their 40s or 50s. For me, like many expecting parents, I just looked at a list of names. I can't pick that one because I know someone with that name and they were an asshole, I'd think as I skimmed the baby names. Finally, I narrowed it down to a few. And chatting with Helen, I settled on Sarah. Yes, it might seem like a pretty generic name to some, but for me it just felt like it fit. Every Sarah I knew was smart and funny and exuded a type of casual femininity that I identified with. I picked the name the night before I came out to my parents. I wanted everything to be as firm as possible, since I knew they'd latch on to any sense of uncertainty. It all had to feel real to them, and having a name made it real. During the 5 months between coming out to my parents and coming out publicly, my friends did an amazing job of calling me McBride in public and Sarah in private. They also took the initiative, with my permission, to cover up my old name on a student government campaign poster hanging in my campus office, replacing it with Sarah McBride for SG President. Writing my name on that White House application felt good. But given that the name on the application effectively outed me, and I wanted to make sure they understood what the White House was getting, I also made clear in my application essays that I'm transgender. Information that I tried to seamlessly work into my answers, given that one of my primary motivations for wanting to be a part of the Obama administration was to contribute to its work on LGBTQ rights. Helen had actually interned at the White House a year before in the Office of Public Engagement, OPE, a division that grew out of what had been called the Office of the Public Liaison. Ever the community organizer, President Obama expanded the small office tasked with dealing with stakeholder groups to roughly 30 staffers, with point people working with the African-American community, women, Latinos, unions, small businesses, the disability community, and the LGBTQ movement, among others. While Helen's background was in gender equity advocacy, she'd been assigned to the staff for heading up LGBTQ outreach. She had an amazing experience and recommended that I list the Office of Public Engagement as my first choice on the application. So I did. 2 months after coming out, I received the news I had been hoping and waiting for. I had been accepted into the program, and in late August 2012, I prepared to walk into the White House for my first day. In August 2012, trans equality had not yet significantly entered the national public debate like it would in the years that followed. During their first term, the Obama administration had taken several important but lower-profile steps on trans rights. For instance, as the largest single employer in the United States, the president had instructed federal agencies and departments to begin adopting gender identity-inclusive equal employment policies. Such a development was a far cry from the days when people suspected of being LGBTQ were rooted out of their jobs in the executive branch. In fact, up until the Clinton administration, LGBTQ people were routinely denied security clearances simply because of who they were. Perhaps the most significant action taken by 2012 had been by Secretary Hillary Clinton's Department of State when they adopted new policies for changing the gender marker on U.S. passports, allowing people to do so even if they hadn't had gender affirmation surgery. To many, this may seem like a small technical advancement. But in reality, the change was the first major nationwide reform on behalf of transgender people ever. According to a 2011 survey by the National Center for Transgender Equality, only 21% of transgender people who had transitioned had been able to update all of their identity documents to reflect their gender identity. A full third, 33%, lacked any identity document representing their true gender. IDs are among our most utilized documents. They're required to travel, enroll in school, obtain a job, open a bank account, and increasingly and unfortunately vote. There are legitimate arguments that gender is not even necessary on these documents. But so long as driver's licenses, passports, birth certificates, and other IDs include gender markers, it remains critical for them to reflect the gender identity of the person carrying them. Allowing transgender people to update those documents makes a profound statement that we are respected and acknowledged as who we are. They make clear how the person should be treated. Perhaps more important, identification provides a vital layer of security and protection for us. IDs that still reflect a transgender person's sex assigned at birth can out the carrier, exposing them to discrimination, harassment, and potentially violence. Imagine having to reveal a deeply personal piece of information that could put you in danger every single time you fly on a plane, go to a bar, or use your credit card. Prior to the change, the State Department required that individuals undergo gender affirmation surgery in order to update their gender marker. This, unfortunately, was a common, misguided, and burdensome policy that effectively put a $20,000 or more charge on accurate identity documents. And that's just for those who plan on having gender affirmation surgery. Many in the community never do, because they feel like they do not need it, they can't undergo surgery for medical reasons, or they can't afford it. So the change was a major step. Even if other forms of identification were still outdated, the updated passports provided many transgender people across the country with a usable document not just when traveling, but when signing up for loans or applying for a job. Despite the weight of the change for the community, it received relatively little notice by the national media. And the uniqueness of the advancement underscored an early cautiousness on the part of the Obama administration on the issue of trans rights, a fact that likely reflected both the current political environment and a lack of familiarity with transgender people and our lives. In anticipation of my time at the White House, I moved quickly to legally change my name and update my driver's license, including my gender marker. Everyone who works in the White House is issued a security badge that includes the person's legal name in big letters. The badge must be visible at all times, and I didn't want to walk around with my old name staring everyone in the face. For the first 3 months after stepping into the world as myself, before I started at the White House, I had to utilize my old driver's license, with my old name, an old picture, and a big fat M on it. I'd avoid situations where a license was necessary, and in the few instances when I used it, my heart would race as I'd hand my license to whoever was requesting it. "Is this a joke?" one server asked me after I handed her my driver's license while out to dinner with a friend. Stopped for a traffic violation, a male police officer clearly felt uncomfortable interacting with me after I handed him my old driver's license. He fumbled after looking down at my picture. "Hold on a second." He walked back to his car, and a female officer, who felt more comfortable talking with me, exchanged places with him. "Just change your name," many cisgender adults would tell me. But it wasn't that easy. While many people change their name following a marriage or after a divorce, the policies for a name change outside of those contexts usually differ significantly. Each state has slightly different rules, but in Delaware, to change my name, I had to schedule a court appearance, and prior to that, post the name change in 2 newspapers around the state. The policies are vestiges of a pre-internet age and seek to avoid fraud or debt avoidance. The requirements take time and, most of all, cost money. Notices in the newspapers cost a few hundred dollars. Fortunately, my parents helped with the costs. and after a few weeks of notices and two Delaware papers, I went before a judge in Wilmington, Delaware, to have my name legally changed by order of the court. I was nervous but ecstatic for the formal name change to come. I wanted to update my ID, a perpetual asterisk on my identity. But it was deeper than that. Just as each person's love and support lifted my spirits, and being seen as myself made me feel whole, the legal name change would be a clear declaration that my government sees and affirms me. At the courthouse, most people were changing their names to nicknames they had gone by their entire lives. As the proceedings went on, it was clear I was the only person changing a name to transition. The bailiff finally called my name, and I walked slowly up to the lectern in the middle of the room right in front of the judge. "I see you are here to change your name for the purpose of a gender transition," the judge, a young Italian woman with short dark hair, read through the glasses perched on her nose. I could feel the 50 eyes of the audience staring at me. "Yes, Your Honor," I sheepishly responded. The judge looked up, began to smile, and responded, "I'm honored to be a part of such an important day for you. Congratulations. So ordered." I turned around to head to the seat next to my mom. As I walked back into the public section of the courtroom, I kept my head down, trying to avoid eye contact, until I saw a hand jut out in front of me. It was an older man offering me a celebratory handshake. Another woman leaned over and, with a big smile on her face, clapped her hands quietly. And as the hearing ended and we exited the courtroom, several other attendees came up to shake my hand and congratulate me on this step. It was a refreshing experience, despite how nerve-wracking it was. Much like Governor Markell, the judge had modeled the right response for that courtroom. I was grateful to have had such a positive experience. To this day, many transgender people face extra legal barriers to updating their names. Individual judges hostile to trans identities have been known to deny requests for a name change outright, even when they have no legal foundation for doing so. "I will not change a name from an obvious female name to an obvious male name, and vice versa," a judge told a trans man in Georgia. "The DNA code shows God meant for them to stay male and female," another judge in Oklahoma told a trans woman seeking a name change. I thanked my lucky stars that my judge was so supportive. And with my name change now finalized, I put together the forms to change the gender on my license, which required a letter from a health professional effectively verifying my trans identity. With just 2 weeks to spare before the start of my internship at the White House, I received my updated driver's license. I couldn't stop looking at it once I had it in my hands. "Sarah Elizabeth McBride," it read. F. With the new ID in tow, I made my way to the White House for my first day. The West Wing has become synonymous with the White House staff. And while the president and the most senior advisors work in the cramped extension attached to the west end of the White House, the vast majority of the staffers and all the interns are housed in a large building across an alley from the West Wing. Still within the White House grounds, the Eisenhower Executive Office Building, or EEOB in D.C. lingo, looks like a giant gray wedding cake with columns on top of columns. Built just after the Civil War, the building served for 8 decades as the headquarters for the Department of State, as well as the Departments of War and the Navy before they were merged into the Department of Defense. It's a divisive building. Half of my friends think it's the most beautiful structure in D.C., while others side with Mark Twain, who called it the ugliest building in America. Whatever you think, it's an imposing structure, and far grander than the more exclusive West Wing. In my black dress and blazer, I entered the first security checkpoint and handed the Secret Service my new ID. They cleared me to go through, and after walking through double doors into a small corridor lined with large pictures of President Obama and Vice President Biden, I handed my ID over at a second checkpoint. The Secret Service agent looked at my license and, handing me a temporary badge, pointed me through the doors and said, "Welcome to the White House, Ms. McBride." Welcome to the White House, Ms. McBride. Chapter 4. The People's House. I had arrived at the White House early on that first day, about 30 minutes before I was instructed to be there. I entered a conference room on the fourth floor of the EEOB. The towering walls were bright white, and in the center of the room was a large oak table with brown leather chairs on either side. Filling one wall were large windows that looked out over the West Wing and the White House, practically the same view I had printed out images of in middle school and hung in my bedroom. I was the first one to arrive. Standing there alone, I looked around. 3 months before, I had feared that my professional life was over. I took a deep breath and took in the moment. I'm here. I'm about to work in the White House as myself. It's impossible to express the profound liberation and sensation of being able to do something as your true self when for years you've never been able to actually be yourself. That's true for the small things, but particularly so for the moments that would be exciting for anyone, such as beginning an internship at the White House. I had spent my life never truly experiencing moments like this, but now I was fully there. I was truly living. I was also acutely aware that, as far as I knew, no one quite like me, an out transgender woman, had worked in a role like this, even as an intern. I had asked friends in the advocacy community if they knew of any other transgender people who had worked at the White House. They told me that two or three transgender men had interned during the first few years of the Obama administration, but it wasn't clear how out they were to their colleagues. And at the time, no trans person had served on staff yet, a barrier historically broken a few years later by a young transgender woman named Rafi Friedman Gerspan. As the other new interns, a mix of young men and women earnestly dressed in their nicest business attire, began filtering into the conference room on the fourth floor of the EEOB, I sat there nervously. This was my first professional experience outside the safe confines of the LGBTQ movement. While it was only a baby step into a world filled with progressive Democrats, I had quickly learned that such bona fides were no guarantee that a person would be comfortable with and supportive of trans people. The thoughts that had become routine in my mind came rushing in. What do these other interns think of me being here? What will they say? The coordinator of the intern program, a young staffer who would be our main point of contact for the next several months, entered the conference room and stood at the head of the table. "Welcome to the White House, everyone." She began to give us directions. We'd be escorted to our offices. There'd be a security briefing the next day. Looking around at the other interns, I couldn't help but think that while many of our responsibilities overlapped, I held a unique position as a transgender person in that setting. I wanted to utilize my 6 months in the White House to put a human face on trans rights for the people whom I would be working with and for. Even if you hold the right positions on paper, it's easy to deprioritize something that feels abstract. When our workplaces began including openly gay, lesbian, and bisexual people, it changed companies, governments, and people's priorities. Now there would be a trans woman walking the halls, joining them in meetings, and sharing coffee with them. It's impossible for our rights to remain abstract when a person is quite literally sitting across from you. As I had realized throughout my coming out experience, and as I would routinely reiterate, I'm an admittedly imperfect messenger for that role. My privilege and experiences limit my perspective. It's easy to express and genuinely feel empathy for a young, white, conventional-looking trans girl. It's another to maintain that empathy when your differences are compounded by race, gender expression, class, religion, or circumstance. Nevertheless, I'd made it into the White House, and I hoped to utilize it to do some small good. To do that, though, I first had to accomplish my day-to-day responsibilities and do them well. I was assigned to the office I was hoping for, public engagement, and with a staffer I had interviewed with, Gautam Raghavan, the LGBTQ liaison for the White House at the time. Gautam, an openly gay 31-year-old man, had worked within the administration on the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, the military's ban on openly gay, lesbian, and bisexual troops, and moved over to the position within the White House about a year before. A passionate LGBTQ advocate, He had read my public coming out note just 2 days before interviewing me for the internship, and was clearly interested in expanding even further the administration's work on trans equality. In addition to working with Gautam, I was also placed under a whip-smart 26-year-old woman named Monique Dorsonville, who, among other portfolios, managed all of the events for the Office of Public Engagement that included the President and First Lady. Helen had warned me that the hours in the Office of Public Engagement were severe. There were days when I had to be in at 6 a.m. and would not leave any earlier than 9 p.m. But she also told me it would be well worth it. The Office of Public Engagement was located toward the front of the EEOB, which helped spur its nickname, the front door of the White House. The office, tasked with coordinating and communicating with various identity-based communities across the country, was filled with motivated and friendly young staffers, former organizers, and advocates. Many had been with the president since the election, some even earlier than that. There was Darian Rakestraw, who managed outreach to veterans. Darian had previously served as the front desk receptionist in the West Wing, welcoming members of Congress, foreign heads of state, leading advocates, and celebrities for their meetings with President Obama. Her role led the president to nickname her ROTUS, Receptionist of the United States, a play on the nickname staffers use when referring to the president, POTUS. There was Julia Chavez Rodriguez, who managed outreach to Latino communities. Julia was the granddaughter of the noted civil rights and workers' rights activist Cesar Chavez, and a powerhouse advocate in her own right. Nate Tamron oversaw outreach to labor. Nate had been with the president since he was a little-known Illinois state senator running in a seven-way primary for the U.S. Senate. Nate would recount stories from the old days, like his first day working for then-state Senator Barack Obama in 2003. They were placed last in the Chicago St. Patrick's Day parade, forced to dodge poop from the horses that had marched ahead of them. They were so far back in the parade program, he told us, that the visibly inebriated spectators hurled and mocked this new candidate, disgustingly shouting crude comments and comparing Obama's name to Osama bin Laden. 5 years later, rising from complete obscurity, Barack Obama had ascended to the highest office in the world. Change is possible, I thought. The Office of Public Engagement was headed at the time by John Carson, who had managed the field operation for the 2008 presidential campaign. John reported directly to Valerie Jarrett, senior advisor and assistant to the president for public engagement and intergovernmental affairs. No one in the White House was closer to the president and first lady than Jarrett. Their relationship dates back 2 decades to when she hired Michelle Obama for a job in the Chicago mayor's office. Miss Jarrett, or VJ as she was called throughout the office, would end up sticking by the president's side through all 8 years of the administration. The office combined the excitement and breakneck pace of a campaign with the seriousness of cause of government work, and the staff treated the interns like full partners in that effort to, as President Obama often said, build a more perfect union. And we all became close, working late nights practically every day. As an intern, my responsibilities did not include the stereotypical fetching of coffee and making copies. I worked with Gautam on LGBTQ engagement and Monique on major events with the president, from meetings with progressive leaders to a welcoming ceremony for the returning U.S. Olympians and Paralympians. While the hours were long, each day went by in the blink of an eye, filled with meetings, incredible events, and the occasional sighting of the president or first lady. There was a constant buzz and energy that permeated the halls connecting the various offices. It became clear very quickly that the Office of Public Engagement was a family atmosphere, filled with true believers. People who not only believed in President Obama, but also the mission of the administration. It was hard not to be inspired by the work. Each day we invited in members of mostly marginalized communities so they could hear a little bit about what the administration was doing to help, and we could hear from them about what more should be done. And it wasn't just advocates living and working in D.C., but leaders from across the country, activists from South Carolina and Michigan, Kansas and Alaska. If you ever, even for a moment, forgot where you were, You were snapped out of your jaded spell by the awe-inspiring comments from people who may have never dreamed of coming to the people's house. There was a reason that the saying in the office was, "You can't spell hope without OPE." For the first few weeks, I had worked and engaged with my fellow interns with the presumption that they automatically knew I was transgender. I had lived the last 4 months figuring that everyone could tell, either because of how I looked or how I talked. But one afternoon, riding down the elevator with a fellow intern, Sonia, it became clear that not everyone realized my background. Still, I was wearing that long brown wig. As I scratched an itch, I commented, "I can't wait to get rid of this thing." "What do you mean?" Sonia responded curiously. "This wig. I can't wait to get rid of it," I said, figuring that it was clear what was on top of my head. "I didn't realize you were wearing a wig," she exclaimed, genuinely surprised. She paused for a moment and considered her next question. "Can I ask why you're wearing a wig?" "Because my hair's still too short for my liking," I responded. She looked confused. I stared at her for a few seconds, not getting the obvious. "Wait," I hesitantly responded. "You know I'm transgender, right?" "You are?" Her eyes widened. "No, I didn't. But I guess that explains some things." I had come out only 4 months before and was surprisingly jarred by the exchange with Sonia. A few months earlier, I had upended my life and jumped into a new world, operating under the assumption that my trans identity was self-evident. Every decision I made was influenced by that fact. And if strangers on the street didn't know, sure enough, everyone with whom I had an extended conversation would come to the conclusion one way or another, I thought. Somewhat dazed, I walked back into the office I shared with my boss, Monique, and a gregarious tall New Yorker named Jared who managed Jewish outreach for the White House. Next to Jared and Monique were two large desks, one for Gautam and another for our intern coordinator, Quinn. It was a small room, made even smaller by our 4.5 desks and the piles of paper scattered everywhere. Hovering just over my computer screen was a large print, a jumbo as they're called in the White House, depicting President Obama eating an apple at a grocery store. I sat at my desk and turned toward Quinn and Gautam. I just had a really surprising interaction with Sonia. She didn't realize I was trans. A smile spread across Quinn's face. "Oh yeah, Akshar," another intern in our office, "didn't realize that either. I was talking about your coming out and he had no idea." My heart sank. Quinn had said nothing wrong, but for some reason this news hit me like a ton of bricks, and I didn't know why. "Do you think the others know? Should I tell them?" I asked Gautam. "I don't know if they do, but how are you feeling? You seem a bit shaken," he responded in a soft, paternal voice. On the one hand, I thought I would be happy that they didn't know. I'd wanted to blend in for months. But something just felt off. I was confused and didn't fully understand my reaction. There had been several times, from the server on my date with Andy to strangers on the street, when I'd been hurt by the fact that I figured someone could tell I was trans. There were a few things I thought I had wanted more than to pass, a term frequently used to describe when someone is not read as transgender. I also hated myself for that reaction. There is nothing wrong with being trans. I knew that. But in a society filled with messages that to be read as trans is to be perceived as ugly, it becomes hard not to internalize that observation. I shouldn't want to pass, but I did. Or at least I thought I did. There is no question that a trans person being able to blend in comes with a great deal of privilege. At the most base level, blending in becomes a source of physical security for many transgender people. If people cannot tell you are transgender, the risk of facing anti-transgender violence or discrimination decreases dramatically. I recognize that the mere ability to feel uneasy about passing is a privilege in and of itself. Nevertheless, I couldn't shake the odd feeling. Sitting at home that night, it finally began to make more sense. Was I disappointed because, as someone said, I wasn't being honest with people? No. No one is entitled to any information about me or who I am. These folks were seeing me as a woman, which I am. They just didn't know that I was also transgender. Seeing me as a woman isn't a deception. Was I disappointed because I was nervous how people would react when they found out? No. I knew by now that my colleagues would greet my news with support. I realized that I was disappointed because I want people to know who I am because I'm proud of who I am. I'm proud to be transgender. Our identities matter. They help make us who we are and shape our outlook. Existing in them is a radical act, one that requires, in many instances, courage, hard work, and determination. I am a better person because of the experiences and insights that I've had because I'm transgender. I'm a more compassionate person than I was before I accepted that part of my identity. I've joined a community of people who have made the empowering decision to live whole, complete lives. We have stood up to a society that tells us that we are wrong, to live our lives to the fullest. It's a daring act of authenticity. There is no doubt that society places unfair and unjust barriers in front of transgender people. But that is a flaw in society, not a problem with being transgender. Still, for many, being publicly out and proud is not an option, even for those who have transitioned. Too often we universalize the need for LGBTQ people to be out in order to move equality forward. This is an unfair burden to bear for an already marginalized community. Some of us may decide to be out, and there's no question that that is a good thing. But we shouldn't force anyone to live their gender or sexuality in a particular way, even if we feel that there may be long-term benefits for the movement. Every person's life is their own. Their experience is too precious for others to require them to betray their own security or well-being to make a point. This is particularly true for transgender people, for whom being out about that identity may significantly inhibit their ability to be seen totally as their own gender. This is no doubt a result of a world that often denies our gender identity when people find out that we are trans, and it can cause real pain that no one should have to go through. I've been blessed with a community that does not see my womanhood and transness as mutually exclusive. I won't lose my job or my friends. I'm less likely to face violence. These realities allow me to be public, and in my mind, those privileges call on me to utilize whatever platform I have to try to open hearts and change minds. Being student body president allowed me to do that. And now being at the White House gave me that opportunity with some of the most powerful people in the country. A week after the exchange with Sonia, I was sitting at my tiny desk working on a memo outlining all of the outstanding policy goals of the transgender community, from inclusive health coverage to an executive order banning discrimination by companies that do business with the federal government, when the door opened. I swiveled around in my chair to see Michael Strautmanis. Strautmanis, affectionately called Strat in the White House and well-liked within OPE, is part of the original Chicago Obama world. He first met Michelle Obama when he was a paralegal for her at Sidley Austin, the law firm where Michelle first met and fell in love with Barack. Strat had moved to Washington when Obama was elected to the Senate, serving as his chief counsel. After serving in senior roles in the presidential transition, he joined the White House staff, and when I interned in 2012, was a deputy assistant to the president and senior counselor to Valerie Jarrett. A few days before Strat walked into my office, I had run into him in the hallways. As I was making my way through the bright corridors of the EEOB, he motioned for me to walk with him to his next meeting. He was likely trying to get to know the different interns and asked me about my background. I told him where I was from, where I went to school, my different interests. I didn't mention my trans identity. Now, peeking into my office, he again motioned for me to join him in the hallway. I popped up from my desk and joined him in the hallway where we had talked 3 days before. "I hope this isn't inappropriate," he started. "But I didn't realize you were transgender when we were talking last. Yesterday I was in a meeting with Valerie and trans issues came up. I mentioned that I didn't know any transgender people and there were none in the White House when she stopped me and said, 'We have a transgender intern. You need to be more aware of your surroundings.'" He continued, I was really hoping we could maybe get lunch and you could tell me a little bit more about your story if you're comfortable. I could tell he was worried about making me feel tokenized, but I had told my bosses that I was more than willing to talk with anyone about trans rights. When I later mentioned the conversation to Monique and Gautam, they made clear that he had talked to them before approaching me. I would absolutely love that, I told Strat eagerly. A week later, we met for our lunch. We sat down over sandwiches at a lunch shop located catty-corner to the White House complex. Over our meals, I recounted my journey. He occasionally interjected with questions, but mostly listened. After I finished telling him my story, Strat reflected on his own background as a black man from Chicago. He then told me about the attitudes toward LGBTQ people in his neighborhood growing up. We never talked about this when I was a kid. Though looking back, he said there was someone who lived down the street from him when he was growing up who may have been transgender. We sat for an hour, a significant amount of time for someone in a senior leadership position at the White House. I had the opportunity to humanize an issue, a group of people, for an old friend of the president and a senior staffer at the White House. No more could Strat say he didn't know anyone who was transgender. At the time, the percentage of Americans who said they knew someone who was transgender was still in the single digits. As trans activist Faye Seidler quipped, more Americans said they had seen a ghost than knew a transgender person, according to some polls. For much of the first term of the president's administration, a similar percentage of White House staffers would likely have said the same thing. Increasingly, though, that was changing. Not just because of my presence, but because more and more transgender people were coming to the White House for events and meetings. Increasingly, that included a prominent trans health advocate, my friend Andy. Since our date in August, just a few months earlier, I'd thought about Andy a lot. Almost every morning on my way to the White House, I'd listen to the song that he had played for me in his car on our first date. But our communication also grew infrequent. He'd text me to let me know he was thinking about me, to share a funny experience, or to see if maybe I would be free to have dinner with him. I was unfortunately running around so much and working such late hours that we managed to meet up only twice for dinner, and I rarely texted him back. Nevertheless, he persisted. Time and again, he could have given up. He could have thought, this isn't fair and this isn't worth it. But he didn't. He was patient and gave me the space I needed. All the while, I found out later, forwarding my admittedly infrequent texts to his friends and asking for their interpretation. What do you think this means? He'd ask them. Should I take this as a good sign? I worried about giving Andy the wrong impression. I wasn't sure if I was really ready for a relationship. The White House was consuming my time, and I was still settling into my new life. I don't know if I have room for someone else, I thought. In November, 3 months into my internship and just after the president's re-election, my boss Gautam was scheduled to have a meeting with LGBTQ activists to discuss priorities in the new term. I wasn't planning on attending Gautam's meeting, as I had to help my other boss, Monique, with a meeting that the president was hosting in the West Wing. Across the alley from the EEOB, Monique and I walked through the double doors to the West Wing and down a narrow hallway to the Roosevelt Room, a large conference room across the hall from the Oval Office. A portrait of Theodore Roosevelt riding a horse hangs over a large fireplace at one end of the room. His Nobel Peace Prize hangs just to the left of the mantel, and a large oak table fills the space. Surrounding the table are 16 seats, including one that rises about 2 inches above the rest. That seat is reserved for the president. Guests were about to arrive, so Monique and I hurriedly set up the room. I placed the president's coaster in its place and a placard that read "The President" at his seat, as if anyone would have dared take his chair. "Oh, we forgot a few nameplates," Monique nervously exclaimed. "Can you run back to our office and get them?" Before she could finish the sentence, I was sprinting to our office. As I turned the corner, I noticed a group walking down the columned marble hallway. They had their backs to me, but I noticed in the center of the pack what appeared to be a man about a foot shorter than the rest, dressed in a nicely fitted suit. "That looks like Andy," I thought to myself. "Wait, that is Andy." I was afraid if I called to him, I'd signal something I wasn't ready for. I still hadn't sorted everything out. Or so I thought. "Don't say anything. He'll get the wrong impression." "Andy," I yelled down the hall almost uncontrollably. Andy, startled by the outburst, turned around. He looked just as suave as he had when he got out of his car on our first date. When he realized that it was me who had called out to him, a smile crossed his face. He knew exactly what it meant. And I knew what it meant, too. It seems simplistic, but standing in that hallway, I knew that I would eventually be with Andy. And I knew this is what I wanted. A few weeks later, when a friend of Andy's and I were scheduled to serve on a panel together back in Delaware, Andy enthusiastically volunteered to give up his entire weekend to come along on the thinly veiled pretense that his friend needed a ride, an otherwise cheap and easy trip on Amtrak. Wanting to save both of them the cost of a hotel room and to spend more time with Andy, I invited them to stay with me at my parents' house. Although the house was about an hour away from the panel site, Andy quickly jumped at the offer. Even though he was technically the tag-along on the trip, Andy was an instant hit with my parents and my friends. He made a lasting impression on my mom when, as I slept in on Saturday morning, Andy made his way downstairs to our kitchen. As my mom washed dishes, he sat down at our kitchen table and said with a familiarity that my mom's warmth instantly invites, "Sal, come on over. I'd like to get to know you." My mother sat down with him and talked about our family and our story, about their fears when I came out, but about how positive the trajectory had been. Then she asked Andy about his life. Every relationship is the result of a series of events and coincidences that lead people to one another. For both Andy and me, our developing relationship was built on a unique shared experience, the byproduct of years of each of us fighting to be ourselves. While there were a number of different reasons I was falling for Andy, our shared identities as transgender people were at the center of those early interactions. And for both of us, it was a connection a lifetime in the making. Andy's own journey had begun a few years before mine. He was born in 1986, 4 years before me, in the small town of Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin. "That's where Leonardo DiCaprio's character in Titanic is from," I exclaimed when he first told me the name of his hometown. "Yeah, our town went wild when Jack said that in Titanic," he laughed. "One of the biggest things to happen to us." Andy had a fairly privileged childhood, much like mine. If my neighborhood in Delaware was like Leave It to Beaver, Andy's Chippewa Falls was Mayberry. The tree-lined neighborhoods were filled with American flags hanging from the porch of every other home. A main street with brick front stores leads down to the Chippewa River. And with just over 13,000 residents, everyone knows one another. Andy's family, the Crays, was almost like Chippewa Falls royalty. His grandfather, Seymour Cray, was considered the father of the supercomputer, the precursor to our modern personal computers. In the computer industry, Seymour Cray, a brilliant but eccentric man, was the 1960s and 70s version of Bill Gates. Cray Research, which consistently produced the fastest and most advanced computers in the world under Seymour's leadership, was one of Chippewa Falls' largest employers for decades. Seymour's first wife was Vereen, a feisty minister's daughter who was so progressive that during the height of the Vietnam War, she managed to get herself appointed to the Chippewa Falls Military Draft Board just so she could ensure that only those who wanted to serve were drafted. Seymour and Vereen had three children, Susan, Carolyn, and Andy's father, Stephen. In the late 1970s, as a law student at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, Stephen married an incoming law student, Artis Audorf. And after graduating and starting their own separate careers as attorneys in Chippewa Falls, Stephen and Artis had two kids, Andy and Scott. From a young age, Andy was clearly talented. He started talking early. He was athletic, playing baseball and basketball. He was artistic, learning multiple musical instruments, from the clarinet to the drums, from the guitar to the trombone. He was also a rule follower. Once, when asked what the worst thing he'd ever done was, an 8-year-old Andy replied, "Sometimes when my mom tells me to go to my room and think about what I've done, I don't think about it." As with any transgender person born before the 21st century, when Andy was growing up, transgender identities were out of sight and out of mind for most. And while he asserted nearly from day one that he was a boy, his parents, like most at the time, just assumed he was a tomboy. For his fourth birthday, he was consumed with the concern that people would give him girls' toys for his birthday. "What do I do if someone gives me a doll?" he asked his mom. "Tell them thank you and we'll return it later," she instructed him. A few days later, Andy was given a Barbie by a family friend, Mitch. "Thank you. We'll return it later," he announced. In middle school, Andy's parents divorced. Stephen went on to marry a woman he went to high school with, and Artis married the father of one of Andy's best friends, the town's dentist, Richard Sweeney. At about the same time that Andy's parents separated, and still clearly trying to find himself, Andy became an evangelical Christian, a not uncommon phenomenon for LGBTQ people struggling with their identity. Despite neither of his parents being particularly religious, Andy became a dedicated member of a church in Chippewa Falls throughout high school. After graduating as valedictorian from Chippewa Falls High School, Andy moved to Chicago to attend Northwestern University, first majoring in film, and then following in his parents' footsteps, law. Andy's faith remained a significant part of his identity when he went to college, but he was increasingly struggling with his other identities. He took a big step when he started dating his first girlfriend, Heather, and when he started venturing out into queer circles. It was at a queer sorority party on campus during the first semester of his freshman year that Andy met another first year named Kelsey. In no time, the two became best friends. Both Andy and Kelsey identified as lesbians and evangelical Christians at the time. Together, they'd grapple with their mutual identities. They started an LGBTQ Bible study together. They'd explore gay life in Chicago's LGBTQ neighborhood, Boys Town. Already into Star Wars, it was through Kelsey that Andy's interest became a joint obsession. Andy was R2-D2 to Kelsey's C-3PO. Throughout sophomore year and the summer after, Andy began to read more and more online about trans identities. Like me, budding social media platforms like LiveJournal and MySpace opened up a window to people who were just like Andy. And when he returned to school for junior year, he and Kelsey met back up. "I think that I'm a guy," Andy blurted out. Kelsey looked up. "Me too," he responded. Andy's admission had given Kelsey the permission to open up about his gender identity too. "I feel like we're brothers." So they stepped out into the world and began their transitions together. Chapter 5. The Political is Personal. "Why doesn't Andy join us?" my dad piped in, clearly excited about his own idea. In just a week, our family was scheduled to fly to Barbados for a family trip. My dad had rented a house on the southern Caribbean island with close friends and their family. Unfortunately, the other family backed out due to a work-related conflict. Sitting around a table at a restaurant in downtown Wilmington, Delaware, my parents and I brainstormed people to join us and to help fill the house, which was now twice as large as what was needed. "I'm serious. What about Andy?" Bringing Andy on the family trip had crossed my mind. Both my parents had come to love him since that first visit to our house in Delaware a few months earlier. They were both as excited about my budding relationship with Andy as I was. Since finishing up my semester internship at the White House, Andy and I had been spending more and more time with each other. The kindness I saw on that first date proved to be as real as his brilliance. When he was working, we were texting or chatting over GChat. When he wasn't working and I wasn't in class finishing up my final semester of college, we were together. I was spending an increasing number of nights at Andy's apartment, located in a large Art Deco building at the top of a hill in the center of Washington. His apartment was an eclectic mix of mature adult and immature kid, with his law books displayed on a shelf right next to the toy robots he had collected throughout his childhood. Andy's place felt like a home, filled with pictures, knickknacks, framed artwork, and toys for Andy's two black and white cats, Flapjack and Waffles. After 4 years of sparsely furnished and cold college student apartments, Andy's one bedroom was a welcome and warm escape from campus. We'd sit on his big L-shaped brown couch and indulge in our favorite pastime, eating. Fortunately for both of us, Andy was an exceptional cook. On his nights, he'd orchestrate a delicious, elaborate meal with sides and restaurant-quality protein. Flavorful roasted chicken? Check. Perfectly cooked salmon? Check. On my nights, I'd whip out store-bought taco mix or spaghetti. ever the kind soul, Andy would eat those meals as if the greatest chef had made them. And each night was like a date night. We'd dim the lights, light some candles, and eat our delicious, or not so delicious, home-cooked dinners. Even though Andy was working a traditional full-time job as an advocate at the Center for American Progress, he'd operate on my college student schedule, staying up late with me to watch movies and, perhaps most commonly, enjoy our mutual addiction to terrible reality television. We'd talk into the early hours of the morning about events, policy, and the law, and explore issues of philosophy and morality. He'd challenge me to be a better person. He'd encourage me to fight for equality in a way that respected every person's dignity, to abide by certain unbreakable first principles. When a conversation about outing anti-equality politicians who are secretly LGBTQ themselves came up, he pushed back when I initially sided with the arguments that we should expose those politicians' hypocrisy. "There are certain lines we should not cross," he told me. "Yes, hypocrisy is bad. But if exposing that hypocrisy requires us to commit an even greater evil, then we shouldn't do it. We should challenge people on their ideas. We won't bring others to our side by harming people, even hypocrites. It may feel satisfying. It may even be in pursuit of the good of revealing hypocrisy, but it violates a first principle." I still pushed back, "But these people are harming so many others with their policies." "What if you outed someone and they committed suicide because of it?" he shot back. "That's not an impossible outcome. Is revealing hypocrisy worth someone potentially losing their life? Are you willing to bear the responsibility for that outcome? Is that one person's hypocrisy really worth, potentially, their life?" He was right. Principles are worth something only if you stick by them even when they feel inconvenient. It's easy to rationalize and find seemingly altruistic reasons for betraying a moral imperative. But that's exactly when our principles are most important. We shouldn't try to build a world in which every person has individual agency over their own gender or sexual orientation by utilizing tactics that remove or undermine that right. If your ultimate goal isn't an unbreakable principle, then what is? I was in awe of Andy. His insights repeatedly blew my mind. As someone still in college and 4 years Andy's junior, the more I got to know him, the more I was amazed that he was interested in me. But that was the thing about Andy. He'd routinely make clear that he felt the same way about my feelings for him. We both felt lucky to be with each other, a feeling that only intensified as we discovered, slowly but surely, our shared cringeworthy affinity for baby talk and nicknames. At some point in his life, Andy had started calling his bed a bean pod. And given the fact that neither of us were morning people, we began referring to each other as beans stuck in a bean pod. Soon enough, he became Big Bean to my Little Bean, partly a reflection of our age difference, but more so an ironic commentary on the pervasive gender stereotypes that told us that we should be insecure about the fact that I was taller than him. By the time of our family trip to Barbados, Andy and I were inseparable, either physically together or constantly communicating. So when my dad suggested that I invite Andy, I jumped at the idea. I immediately stepped out of the restaurant and called him. "Bean, I know this is ridiculous, but would you want to come with me and my family to Barbados in a week?" "Are you kidding me?" he responded. I could tell he was giddy at the invite. Fortunately, Andy had flexibility when it came to getting off work for a week on such short notice. He also worked so hard that he was likely overdue for a vacation. "Let me just rework some meetings, but I am so in." His friends later told me that the moment he got off the phone with me, he went into hyperdrive, buying new clothes and bathing suits ahead of the last-minute trip with my family. Together, we flew to Barbados a few days later. Andy, already close with my mom, seamlessly ingrained himself with my family. As two attorneys by training, my dad and Andy listened to the recordings of the Supreme Court's oral arguments on the Defense of Marriage Act and California's ban on same-sex marriage Proposition 8 by the pool. Andy and I routinely cooked breakfast for everyone, serving eggs, bacon, and toast on a beautiful patio table surrounded by a lush green yard and towering palm trees. We rented jet skis with my brother and skied the open ocean, me in the driver's seat and Andy holding on to me for dear life as I dangerously flew over small cresting waves. I could tell he was terrified. On our second to last day in Barbados, Andy and I took the family rental car to the north shore of the island. The day before, my parents had visited the northern end of the island, a sparsely populated area with large cliffs overlooking the ocean, and recommended the site. The drive, they warned us, was an overwhelming 40-minute journey, first through a crowded marketplace with narrow streets and then along a winding road. To make matters more confusing, drivers in Barbados drive on the left side of the road, but still use cars built for driving on the right side of the road. It's like dropping an American-made car onto the streets of London. Andy looked at me, frightened at the prospect. Bean, I don't know if I can drive. That sounds horrifying, he blurted out. I smiled and hopped in the driver's seat, then guided our car through the narrow streets of Spitestown's busy market. The tiny streets were packed. Passers-by surrounded our slowly moving car as traffic drove by in the opposite direction, with each car missing the passenger side mirror by a mere inch or two. Oh my God! Oh my God! Oh my God! I'm going to hit something or someone! I screamed the whole way. Eventually, we made it through the town, completed the winding forested second leg of the trip, and came to a dead end. We were pretty sure we had taken a wrong turn on our way to the main tourist spot along the cliffs, but after seeing the water through some bushes with the sun about to set, we decided to cut our losses and check it out. We parked the car and Andy grabbed a bag from the back seat and followed me toward the water. I made my way through the bushes and sure enough found myself standing atop the towering cliffs lining the northern shore of the island, 200 feet above the ocean. The sun was setting to our left, filling the sky with bright orange and yellow hues, and almost repainting the brown cliffs into a soft gold. The peacefulness of the scene, completely devoid of people, was interrupted only by the crash of the waves on the cliffs directly below. As I turned around, I saw Andy setting down a blanket and pulling out food for a surprise picnic. Sitting on the blanket facing the setting sun, Andy and I took in the beauty of the scene. "It's breathtaking," I said, looking out toward the ocean. Andy didn't respond. "Isn't it, Bean?" I turned toward him, but he was already looking at me. Our eyes met and he took a deep breath. "Can I say I love you?" It had been almost 8 months since our first date and 4 months into our more serious relationship. We were spending nearly every day together, but we hadn't yet said I love you. "Yes, of course you can." "I love you," he said with a warm smile. "I love you too," I responded and kissed him. I had known this moment was coming. As a society, we often get so consumed by the gender identity of transgender people that we forget that behind these national debates on trans rights, behind the newspaper stories and policy papers, are real people. Real people who love and laugh, hope and cry, fear and dream, just like everyone else. When I came out, I never anticipated the possibility of falling in love with another transgender person. It wasn't that I thought about the potential and dismissed it. The possibility honestly never occurred to me. I grew up so isolated in my own trans identity that I always imagined my life as the only transgender person in my community, a permanent solitary existence, not devoid of friends or family, just absent anyone else like me. And while two transgender people falling in love is not uncommon in the trans community, it's certainly the exception, at least in my experience. Our shared identities had connected us, but our connection was so much deeper. We brought out the best in each other, a mutual undying belief that change is possible. If our interests didn't always overlap, they almost always complemented one another. And underlying everything was our drive to push equality forward. When we returned from Barbados, I began slowly moving more and more of my clothes and personal items into Andy's apartment. My signed Obama campaign poster was placed just under his Hillary decaled skateboard on the wall. Some of his toy robots had to make way for my Delaware knickknacks. We talked about our future together. I told him I eventually wanted to move back to Delaware, and we talked about how he would be able to continue to work in D.C. or find something in Philadelphia, just a 30-minute drive from my hometown of Wilmington. At the time, I was also preparing to graduate from American University. And with graduation on the horizon, I started exploring moving home. My love for Delaware is boundless. I'm known as the ultimate statriot, a word my friends made up as a mix between state and patriot. When anyone asks me where I'm from, I always respond, "The greatest state in the Union, Delaware." Washington was exciting, but the pace was exhausting. The slower life and the smallness of Delaware were always more attractive to me. It is a state.